You're listening to The Film Sommelier with Caleb Brown, a production of The Story Locker. Pour yourself a glass of wine, sit back, relax, and enjoy the insights into your favorite films. Today, we're tasting Pixar's The Incredibles. Welcome to The Film Sommelier podcast with Caleb Brown.
That's me.
His brother Ben Brown.
Oi.
And I am your liaison, Charlie Deist. Picking up the thread of a film analysis of The Incredibles. So since our last podcast, a lot has happened. Of course, last week, The Incredibles 2 came out, and it sold a record $180 million in tickets in North America. That's a record for any animated movie. And in an equally stunning feat, The Story Locker last week released its latest Shortcuts episodes. Are you ready to watch The Incredibles 2? And we also launched a new version of the website at thestorylocker.com, which people can check out and download our free PDF giveaway showing the four hidden principles of storytelling through the lens of the movie WALL-E. So I saw The Incredibles a couple days after you guys, and the first thing, the only sort of spoiler that you gave me was that maybe it was a little bit less philosophical than the first one, but that it was still a very good movie. Both points I think I agree with, but I want to get deeper into that, what it was about the first Incredibles movie, first of all, to recap, that made it philosophical and those philosophical stakes that we talk about that give a movie its soul.
Yeah, the first movie, it had a clear, you know, what I call a patient character, someone who learns a lesson viscerally, and Bob Parr is a character who learns something. He learns that he was a vain, disengaged father, and this crazy adventure helped him see that his life was worth paying attention to now, even though the world wasn't allowing him to operate to the full extent of his gifts. And there was a personal connection with Brad Bird in making the film, because at the time he was making it, he wasn't allowed to pursue the kind of work he wanted to do. So he brought his own kind of the competing values of doing big time work in the film industry versus doing, you know, raising a family the way he'd like to raise one. And I think that found its expression in the first film. The second go around, it's really harder to see. Like, if anything, he might be trying to respond to the accusations that the first Incredibles movie was a hidden Ayn Rand vehicle. Like, the character who sounds most like Ayn Rand is actually the villain in this film. And so it got me thinking about, well, who's the patient in Incredibles 2? Like, who learns their lesson? And there's not a lot of solid answers. I suppose there's a moment where the story pauses where Bob learns...
Spoiler alert! Just yeah. For anybody. Incredibles 2 spoiler, if you didn't guess.
There's like only three moments I can think of that might point to some sort of lesson going on. One is when Bob is down in the dumps and he's trying to do everything himself, and like he's been struggling with a sense of like battling a feeling of incompetence the entire film. And at one point he kind of admits, like, yeah, I don't know what I'm doing. I'd like to act like I know what I'm doing, but I don't. And his daughter chimes in and says, you know, well, you're a super dad. And then there's a moment where Helen, yeah,
that's a good moment.
There's a moment where, so, well, let's come back to that.
What's the basic synopsis of the movie?
Of Incredibles 2?
Yeah.
So far, just having a
It picks up exactly where the first film left off. Like, the Underminer appears, and so we launch into that, and the superhero family gets to do their thing for the first time, but it creates massive destruction for Municiburg. And in the end, the people are like, look, these buildings are insured. Like, you cause more damage trying to stop a bank robber than if we just let him rob the bank.
That was kind of my comment. My Straussian take on The Incredibles was that actually the people who were complaining about the superheroes were right, because deposits are insured. And, you know, all this collateral damage just ends up being way worse than what the bad guys could do on their own if there weren't any force trying to stop them in their tracks completely. So it picks up there, and then we get to kind of the meat of the film's plot, which is Helen is tapped as the new spokesperson for superheroes, or the poster child for reviving the superhero.
Make supers legal again.
Right. Yeah.
And Bot, they choose Helen because Helen, through her attention to detail, is produces way less collateral damage than Bob. And you kind of get that sense already. And so...
it's carefully documented in a
dossier Excel, not this thick.
Spreadsheets, yeah. And graphs, yeah.
And so the Bob is, you know, I thought the arc of the film was going to be about Bob struggling with his relegation to parenting. He doesn't. Like, he kind of like dives right into it as like, all right, I don't have this opportunity. My wife's going to pursue it. If she succeeds, then I get to do what I get to do. So I'm going to take this off her plate, the parenting thing, for this. It's not even a season. It's like a moment. It's like a few weeks, as far as I can tell,
yeah.
in the show. So that's not a huge like existential crisis that he's facing. And I thought he was facing issues of like, oh, can I really be myself and be a man anymore while full time watching the kids? It's not like that. It's like special, short time opportunity. She can't do it unless I watch the kids. I'm gonna watch the kids, and then he has difficulties with it.
Yeah, he's more of like he's not like a background character, but he's definitely not going through a huge thing. I felt like Bob, and less of this like internal like changeover and like being, you know, the patient character, as we like to call it, like. He was more just like, it's like, yeah, here's a scenario. Like, some dads are in this boat, and like, now he's just a super relatable dad in this one. Like, yeah, as opposed to being the patient character, he's just like, it's just dads can find themselves in this scenario right now. And it just was, he was super relatable in it, but it wasn't like this huge change, which I think was a good choice. Like, I don't think it needed to be like all about Bob there. Because Helen is definitely takes a show, but I don't know if she changes to be the patient. It's kind of
yeah. I mean, while watching the movie, you're kind of like, man, this is way better action than the first movie, and it's in a. I kind of draw a comparison between Helen and Spider-Man. Helen is the Spider-Man of this universe, like her speed and just the way her powers work. As opposed to Bob's like Superman, and Spider-Man is way more interesting than Superman, I gotta admit. So pointed to, yeah, any internal change for Helen, it's kind of hard to say. Like, she's definitely the hero. She gets the call and she refuses it initially, and Bob's like, no, you can't say no, you have to do this. And her hesitation is like, well, is Bob really gonna have things under control? And so like, there's kind of like the closest thing to a topic that this film is swirling around is sort of control, trust, faith are kind of like the things that are going on. Helen is sort of like, yeah, kind of decides to trust Bob, that he's got her back. And in the climax, she is thinking about sticking around and not going after the villain. Because, you know, who's going to watch the kids, basically. And Bob's like, I got them. And she's like, all right. And they go. Although, that's not a huge change.
No.
Because she already trusted him before.
It seemed almost like a permission. Like,
yeah, yeah.
Like it was fishing for needing permission, but she didn't really.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Or she had been struggling with it before. I would say one thing with Helen is that the villain exploited her a little bit. Like, there's this, you know, I guess, like successful females in high places and this, like, potential camaraderie. I think, like, Helen was in this mindset that she could immediately trust this other, like the billionaire's...
Evelyn.
Mogul, yeah, like sister.
Evelyn Dever.
Evelyn, yeah, and so, like... She had this like kind of immediate trust with her and this kind of like belief that they're like on the same kind of idea. And like, you can tell from the beginning of the movie, Evelyn is like feeding her things. Like, you know, it's like, well, it's like, thank goodness you're doing this over Bob, or like he would make a huge mess of it. Or like, it's like, this is kind of like really kind of playing to her pride, but in this like kind of successful feminine way.
Evelyn's the real underminer here.
Really? Right, yeah, yeah. The actual underminer. So that's that was one thing. It's, I guess it's kind of a hubris or kind of a, like, yeah, I think you like using that term. But, like, it's a little bit of, like, a flaw that got exploited by the villain, like, at Helen's expense. But I don't know if there was, there's not, like, a change. It's, like, she was revealed as evil and then now she's mad at her. Like, it's, I don't know.
Yeah.
It wasn't, like, a huge betrayal. Didn't feel like it.
And then the other moment that might hint at some kind of a theme is the moment, you know, there's this brilliant monologue in the middle where...
My favorite part.
Yeah, Evelyn is talking about the harm that superheroes and screens cause the world and the cause of, like, tearing that down so that people can live their own lives and control their own destinies. So this is the kind of Ayn Randian thing that's going on, sort of. And
superheroes make us weak because we don't have to defend ourselves
anymore.
We rely on them. And we learn that her father was a big fan of superheroes and he had a direct line to these, you know, superheroes of yore. And when he tried to call on them to save his family from house invaders, they didn't answer. And so he lost his life because he was expecting someone to come save the day.
Mm-hmm. And so her philosophy, which I'd consider the anti-theme of the movie, is the only faith worth having is self-reliance. That's her credo.
Yeah.
And I suppose, like, you know, it makes a darkly compelling case in that monologue. At the same time, like, she can't help but be hypocritical in all of her actions, you know, using television to tear it down, like building up a superhero so she could ruin superheroes. So it's, she doesn't have much of a leg to stand on. But so then what is the antidote to that challenge of the only, like, really what we need to have faith in is our own sort of ability to take care of ourselves and not to have to look outside for that. I mean, I suppose the logical opposite is that, you know, the faith worth having is in each other, that we have each other's backs. And if we're normal people, we can believe superheroes have our backs. If we are superheroes, we believe other superheroes have our backs. That kind of faith. It struck me as interesting that, like, in the very first action set piece of the movie, they try and build up, like, you know, the drill that's barreling through the city and they got to stop it. It's headed towards City Hall. That's what it nearly pummels. And they stop it. And, like, there's no, like, plot reason why hitting City Hall is going to be a problem. But it's kind of, like, held up as a symbol. And so, like, City Hall, public trust. I think there's something going on there. And you have the same, and one of the more interesting things, and I was getting so ready to write an article and first things about this, about, like, about frustrated masculinity and the role screens play in the frustration of masculinity and Marshall McLuhan's theory, or basically Marshall McLuhan's theories of, like, what screens do to us as opposed to what print culture did for us. And then another kind of, like, progressive feminist philosopher named Leonard Sneeds, using Marshall McLuhan's research to say, like, oh yeah, print culture was kind of the backbone of the patriarchy, and, like, when in a more screened world, like, yeah, goddess worship and, like, that kind of thing, we can kind of expect to make a comeback. I wanted to talk about all those things, but the movie doesn't hover on these ideas very long. It is interesting that we are talking about screens and their damaging effects. The movie's talking about screens and their damaging effects, but they don't have cell phones then. It's all TV.
Yeah,
and so that's what makes Marshall McLuhan directly relevant to this film.
I read a couple of reviews, some critical reviews. One in or on Vox.com, where the writer said, "Here's a media critique that feels like Neil Postman." I don't know who that is.
He's also a, like, stodgy, like, "Oh, Western world's going down because of TV."
Okay. Yeah. With whiffs of Marshall McLuhan by way of Mr. Robot, which helps also explain why there's so much talk about the system, in quotes. There's an ongoing debate about whether you can really pursue justice if you follow laws that don't lead to the most just outcome. There's a thread about the challenges facing men who are accustomed to being breadwinners when they're tasked with caregiving instead. There are jokes about new math that I presume are subtle jabs about the Common Core, and a line about how most people trust a monkey throwing darts more than they trust Congress. So actually, this point, you mentioned Marshall McLuhan, but that was just one theme that they didn't dwell on for very long, and they have all these other things that they seem to be trying to get in, and that leads to a sort of watering down of each of the philosophical points. So later, the review says, all this happens so fast that it doesn't sustain anything like a coherent argument or philosophy. If Incredibles 2 has a point of view about anything, it's that politicians and laws are, at very best, imperfect. And even when they're trying to do the right thing, they'll probably mess it up. What do you think about that?
I mean, it doesn't... That's not quite how the movie ends, is it? It's sort of...
It's a bit of a hot take.
All the politicians do rally together and they do the right thing and let supers be super. So it's almost like our current laws and our justice system, it may not be operating correctly, and like what corrects that is, it might be the question at issue. And so rather than a kind of like a complete tear down and rebuild sort of thing, we have to like trust that it'll correct itself with maybe with the right people in charge. I don't know. We're going back to Ayn Rand.
I feel like a lot of like any of the themes or any of the issues they're just touched upon, and they're super like current and relevant, like cameras on police officers, like profiling, and the gender role reversal and the domestic life, like all these things are just like really now, but I don't think it necessarily explores it. It just kind of like says it. It's like, here's our context, but like the movie is just an action film.
Like it's totally a popcorn film.
Yeah, that's kind of like what I kind of got out of it. It's an action film that like handles characters, I think, in a nice way, in a way that's not like dumb. Like they handle the characters with care, and they insert cultural relevance, like current cultural like aspects, but it doesn't necessarily say too much about it, with the exception of the screenslaver talking about people not wanting to do, like people preferring to defer to other people, like watching other people do and accomplish things, over like doing and experiencing them themselves. That's like the only thing that kind of like goes into depth from what I'd heard.
Yeah, I mean, to make a movie that isn't as elegant, more elegant in my mind, I think like if anything that comes down on, you have to have faith in an imperfect system's ability to correct itself, I guess.
Yeah. That being sort of the legal system, or
Legal system, system of justice. Yeah.
Yeah, but the screen slaver, the kind of fictitious bad guy, in a way, the bad guy that's a creation of Evelyn. Mm. It ends up. She uses this hypnosis technology to enslave all the superheroes into doing her own bidding. And is there some sort of commentary about how we might be manipulated by the media into following certain, you know, lines that are pre-approved in order to... is there some sort of mind control going on with screens? Maybe not quite so top down directed as it was in the movie, but still, that we're serving someone else's agenda just by consuming information in the way that they choose to present it to us.
That sounds like a Marshall McLuhan kind of thing. Like,
totally, yeah.
Like just by the nature of what it means to watch television, like passively intake information with sound and audio, wires your brain a certain way, and like it goes directly to other parts, and yeah, it's very easy to get manipulated by that stuff. I think you're told. I think in culture we're told what to strive for. I think we're told what success looks like, you're told what you should have, what you don't have, and you should buy to fill that like absence, like all those things, like they're constantly making moral judgments just by like putting attractive people like close to things makes you like know that like it's like, well shoot, I need that thing or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, or I need to be modeled like that, you know, attractive dude.
So knowing how it works is maybe a first step toward immunizing yourself against the effects. What kinds of movie watching tools can we give people that bring them out of that passive watching mode into a more aware state? How do we help
plugging our four hidden designs?
How do we get people to be more
woke? How can we ever do this?
More woke when they're watching movies.
I'm glad you asked, Charlie. Honestly, I mean, like, this is like completely on the level. Like, I went to grad school, studied Marshall McLuhan. And yeah, I wanted to get underneath this question of like, all right, if a director is taking your attention by force and saying, look at this, listen to this at this volume, and now cut to that person's face, like you are passive to the whole thing. The director is in charge of you. So people who know how to manipulate perceptions, they're in charge. Unless you know how they manipulate perceptions, now you're back in charge. So that's part of why I get into this how to watch a movie work. It's empowering viewers to no longer be passive. It may even empower people who only watched movies to, like, you know, make some of their own. Like, they're not going to be the scale of like what you pay at a movie theater, but, you know, there's also, this stuff is relevant even like the YouTube verse and like Twitter verse. This is a lot less hot, as Marshall McLuhan would say. Like, at the same time, like, I feel like the cultural effect of our current media environment is just sort of like this constant outrage cycle. I don't know how we got there, but that's where we're at. Like, that's
Echo chambers or whatever it is, like.
So this isn't something that's addressed in the movie, and I think that's appropriate. This is a total non sequitur, but one of the more haunting moments in the film was the train driver who's hypnotized by the screen and the train moving backwards. Like, there was an actual story in L.A. like of a I don't know if it was Amtrak or Metrolink train driver who was texting while operating the train. 50 people died. And I wonder if that was like on like a direct tie-in. Or like, I couldn't help but think about it when
that's
I watched.
Why
it.
I want computers to drive.
Yeah. Yeah. The problem is people looking at screens. It should just be all screens, no people.
Yeah.
That would be okay.
I don't know. I have my own personal things about people driving one-ton bullets down roads where other people need to walk. I hate it. And then they're just looking at their screens because they can't, like, because they're afraid of the moment of boredom where they have to face the reality of who they are. And like, yeah. Come on, people. Get off your phones. Wrestle with your identity. I'm a little bit of a screenslaver fanboy.
I did notice that, with the exception of the ending and with Helen getting the goggles put on her, I think it was exclusively men that were hypnotized that they showed you.
Oh.
In the first half of the movie. Huh.
Yeah. Yeah, there's even a lady at the studio that wasn't hypnotized, and she told, don't look at any screens.
Yeah. You know, it's Dash who's really into the TV, and then eventually
and
Bob and Jack. It's just like, screens are a gravitational force for the for the men around. There's even some, like, you know, some perceptual psychology that's been written about, you know. Moving images and high contrast stuff, like, it's just what attracts men's attention.
Yeah, that's why I used to hate going to Buffalo Wild Wings. There's like 20 different screens to look at, and I knew I wasn't like talking to friends.
Overstimulating.
Yeah, it took a lot to get over that.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is the scope of the podcast, but I know the point of our meeting is to discuss the creation of Shortcuts, The Incredibles, and the whole multi-month-long process and the pitfalls of it and the successes of it and the, yeah, what happened and then what can we do moving forward.
Postmortem. Let's do it.
Okay. Here in the podcast?
Yep.
Sweet.
So the...
When did we start?
It was in March.
We started in March and it is now mid-June, late June. And so that's about 3 months for a video that is racking up views, and we've got a good start here. But if we want to be the kind of outlet that can churn out, you know, more regular content, get people in the habit of actually watching it and be thought of as credible experts in this area, it seems like volume is a big part of what we need to get better at.
I think minimum one a month.
Man. Yeah. Well, I think the videos are unimportant to the life of Story Locker, so I don't...
Unimportant?
I think I think it's like, it's the good place to put any of your advertising money. Like, if you have an advertising budget, yeah, put it into that. But it is not actually equal, like, I don't know, it has to be considered this kind of like advertising thing, and where you're like, there's the Story Locker, and then there's like the company inside of Story Locker that creates Shortcuts, and you're spending your advertising budget for them, and it's more of like a liability, but you get like some things in it, but it's like, I don't know, it's not the product. It's not what keeps Story Locker a thing. It is like
it is the
separate.
It is. I mean, like,
it's not
fine line between advertising and sales with this thing,
right?
Because you know, it's not. You know, we've put it up publicly available, but the people that see it are the people that I tell to see it. It's almost like a slideshow. It's almost like my version of a PowerPoint. That's like, hey, trust me in what I sell,
which is excellent.
So I actually have already gotten two phone calls out of this video alone. One of which was a guy who's like, you know, I think you're doing some really exciting things. Like, tell me when you, when you have a clear idea of like who you want me to introduce you to, I will. And you know, if our startup gets to a saturation point, I may engage you for story consulting services myself. So that's very helpful. And then like an executive producer on an upcoming sort of low budget Christian film. Just sent some money today for a story consult. All these directly kind of off of this thing. The other thing was like a long time coming. It was just kind of like, maybe we'll do this.
You get like that's like where it's helpful, you know, like that, like when an advertisement catches you in the right time, like, oh, I'm thirsty. Look at that poster. I need to get that. You know?
It always happens to me at 8 p.m. in burgers. I'm just like, I want that burger.
Yeah. But it's like, I think if the goal becomes to make a successful, like channel, like a successful YouTube channel, that would be missing the mark. And I think we would be putting effort in the wrong place. And that's not good. Like, because it's like, for a successful YouTube channel, like, we would need to like make like multi-day like videos. Like,
and we'd need to be on our screens all the time.
Yeah. And I can't do that. I gotta be outside. I just have to.
Yeah. So for the consulting.
Wait, when you say multi-day videos, what did you mean?
Okay, so like successful YouTube videos put out not only a video every single day, but like two or three a day.
Yeah. Well, we're not playing the YouTube channel.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. No, we just have to make it very explicit.
So YouTube is just a very cost-effective online library.
There is no Vimeo game. Nobody is a Vimeo.
I am a Vimeo person. I'm a Vimeo. Excuse me.
I'm a Vimeoer.
Yeah. All of my unboxing videos are exclusively hosted on Vimeo.
In high-depth
Google Drive.
4K unboxing videos. With mood shots.
Yeah. Well, it's cool to hear the
nudity.
Success.
So if my principle for work in general is trying to apply the 80-20 rule, the power law, that, you know, most of the results that you get come from a small portion of the effort. So what did we do in this cycle that produced the most output? What was the you know, the 20% of the work that produced 80% of the...
Good question. The 20%, you know what it was? Hmm. It was the like last couple of hours where Caleb got alone by himself, finished the script, and then Caleb also got alone by himself and like made some huge headway, like 80% of the headway in the video editing.
So I'm the 20%.
Yes, absolutely. For the video?
Yeah.
We had three projects going on.
Yeah.
Although this didn't extend into March. This is only recently when we were trying to do several... We tried several times to do sprints to end these three projects. which is a part of, like, the... It, yeah, I don't know. The, there is, like, moments of demoralization, like, when we didn't hit deadlines and things.
Yeah.
But the three projects for the more recent sprints was make this Incredibles video, but... We need a good website to make any of the traffic that we do create valuable and like able to capture on it. And then like thrown in with the website was also this idea of a free handout that like can go maybe a little bit more in depth about seeing stories clearer, and like that would be a free PDF, like a free giveaway ebook thing to help encourage people to send us emails for that, like it's called a lead generator. So those are the three things that we wanted to create to like have a really effective launch. But this project goes back to March. I don't know.
So what were we doing between March and June 1st?
Oh man.
Well, yeah,
our heads up against the wall.
Yeah, I mean, some of it was my first step was like, hey, there's multiple hands here. Let's distribute that work right away.
Script?
So let's discover the script through everybody, you know, putting their Predator hat on and constructing, you know, like 30-second segments of what might be part of the video. I still want to try that idea out sometime.
Nope.
Probably not on, probably not with you guys.
Okay.
It is how Pixar works. Like. You get professional, creative people together, and they start exploring stuff and sharing it immediately, and it kind of like steadily becomes one thing. Mm-hmm. So,
I remember
talking about like the iceberg, like the tip of the iceberg was, me locking the script, me sitting down at the editing station, knocking out 80% of it in one night, and then taking two or three more days to sort of polish the rest, and with Ben coming out on the sound. So that's just the top of the iceberg. The bottom of the iceberg is figuring out what the hell to say. So that's the movie presentation.
So yeah.
The attempts at writing.
Yeah, I can go back chronologically. I think.
Yeah, and then having a really, I thought like we got a lot of mileage out of these podcast routines, like finding stuff that felt interesting. So there was the,
And these were
thinking we go down the like the gender norm angle seemed promising. Honestly, I think we probably have, 5 to 10 times more views if we continue down that direction. But they may not have been the right views.
No.
And then, like, meeting again and talking it through with Charlie, it was just me and him once. It was a lot of good material that came out. In fact, that's kind of, like, where I found our conclusion, in a sense.
Oh, nice.
And then, like, having, like, a killjoy like Matt Horwitz come over and be like, yeah, you're doing two things. I'm sorry. You should do one of them. And you should do the one that you can do the best.
Having a killjoy that you really respect.
Exactly, yeah.
And one that, hasn't been saying the same thing from the beginning. Not that I was always. But. So chronologically, the way the first step of this project back in March, like when I got here, you guys had done a how to watch a movie where you sat down, played it, paused it, asked what was going on, and I, so you guys did that. So that's probably, that was step one. and you guys recorded it. And then I went back through and I listened to the pauses and the plays, and I had set that up to like play with the movie in a thing and listen to it. And then we all distributed that, and then everybody like wrote notes on it. And then we came in, we had like several like meetings where we like coming in for the meetings was like, it's like, do we have everybody? Well, no. Okay. Well, what's going on? It's like, did we schedule this in time? It's like, when did we decide that? Oh, last week. Did we email anybody? Well, no, I guess not. And then it's like, okay, well, is this effective? Well, I guess let's just keep going. And then it's like, let's brainstorm now. Like trying to do writer room things. And then, yeah, I think I was gone for a bit. You distributed script assignments to people to write a different section.
Charlie was gone for a bit.
And then whenever I came back, we distributed, we thought about, giving people editing sections.
Mm-hmm.
And then I became very like rigid about creating a terrible shortcuts video. And we pulled teeth and we fought and we actually got it done. We created a terrible version of it, and then it kind of laid a little bit dormant, and maybe didn't know what to do. And then we needed a script. It was not complete and we couldn't really do anything. And then we set up our three projects to get it done. And then we thought we were lost because we had set up several week-long things where it's like, we're going to do this like this 1 week, and then we're going to do 10-hour, 12-hour days, and then not finish it. And then not finish it. And that happened a couple times. It was awful. Yeah. I don't want to do it again. Anyways.
Yeah, no, that is the most demoralizing part of the story. I watched the special features on The Incredibles, and there was an interesting one where it was kind of a roundtable discussion with Brad Bird and his kind of inner circle of creative people. One of the guys made the comment that like working with Brad Bird is like being a fireman. When there's stuff to do, it's full on. It's like all hands on deck. Like we're going after it. We're really intense. Most of the time, you get to screw around. Like you're just like, you know, your guy's in the firehouse waiting for a call. Or you're, you know, shooting baskets and cleaning stuff. It's like that's, and
so it's a good segue for the work rules that I want to establish.
Yeah, yeah. So it struck me as like, oh, that sounded like something kind of familiar like that. Really until there's a script, there's nothing for anybody to do. And that should be okay. Instead of like, I got excess capacity. Or, there's people here. They need busy work. I don't think that's...
Yeah, Ben, you said this is a good segue for your work rules.
Yeah.
This is like a section of this podcast unto itself. Ben's work rules.
Yeah, yeah. Work rules with a...
Oh, nice. Rules.
With an exclamation. I had some proposals like looking back. Like, one, I have my own personal agenda of how much I want to work, which is actually very little. I want to work like just isolated, intense moments, and that's it. And I think that the capacity for that, like what I like to getting into flow and how much quality work you can do, the upper limits of that is just 4 hours. And like, and even then, you have to take a break to do that. And so it's like max.
Let me chime in and say, yeah. So I feel like a lesson in contrast was like we gave ourselves 90 minutes to finish our PDF giveaway. We sat there for 90 minutes and we finished it. And we had fun doing it, and we had fun afterwards.
It was good enough for Joe.
It was totally good enough for Joe.
Yeah. That was a taste of some of my work rules.
All right.
I'm trying to figure out whether this is the best place to interject or to hear the monologue and then chime in with this piece, which is, one thing that's been vague from the beginning is, both you guys enjoy a below market rate room at this courtesy of the Story Locker with some very vague expectations of contributing to the story locker. Charlie, for one, has been like extremely generous with like, oh, that kind of means like I'm on call and like, I can, you know, I only have like this number of hours work this week. I guess the rest I can say is the story lockers and like, yeah. So I think maybe it's a good idea to kind of like actually specify a value. I don't know if that helps. Like, I mean, I think it's not insane to say like X number of hours.
You're getting into like needing to give busy work territory there.
You think?
Yeah. Yeah. I think with this particular group, like, I think as long as you give a quality challenge, like a quality task that like they can actually get into and like know when it's done and like make progress and have it be finished and like all the rules around it are very clear, they'll do that. So if I think we can just go right into my monologue, because it's like, the three big things that I like want to establish is just a 4-hour work day as a concept. Like, I think you can only work for 4 hours, and then a good life work balance, and then accountability. So those are the three things that I thought would be huge, because like if we make it like, hey, the requirement for work is actually really low, like less hours, like you need accountability to make that work. And then I think like, yeah, it's like there's just a lot of life stuff, like you're a dad, like you need to be there. And I think a lot of your work can be done in like a shorter period of time, as long as you and everyone else respects the small amount of time that you need to really get into flow and do some work.
I mean, is it small? I'm trying to think of the last time I did 4 straight hours on anything was that all night bender on editing. So like, even, yeah, like doing 4 hours of work in a day would be like an improvement on my productivity at this point.
Yeah.
But
and I'm suggesting starting small, like a max, like deep focus, deep work session is like an hour and a half. Mm-hmm. And then you take like another hour break, and then you do another hour and a half, and like, and then that's it. Like, that's, you're maxed out. That took 5 hours of time, and like you had 2 great sessions where you got like deep work done, and that's great. Like, that's like the expectation. So for the,
so the 4 hours isn't even like 4 hours of work. It's like three hours of work.
4 hours of break. Flow. Yeah.
So
you could do, yeah, like a 5-hour day, like if you were going into an office or whatever. So this is my thoughts for it. It's like that's more of my own personal how I want to work. These suggestions that I'm about to make is for us, like as a group. And so the rules are just like, I think we should have stand-up meetings that we just are default and automatic, and you don't have to ask if they're happening or not. And I think it should, and we can decide whatever they are. I thought it would be either Monday, Friday, or Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And it like, it's a meeting that cannot exceed 10 minutes. It's like a 5-10 minute meeting. And they're on default. We set them up. They just happen. And we don't have to talk about them ever again. The thought is on Mondays, we'll like each of these meetings will, you'll either be given a challenge, like you'll be given a thing to work on, or you'll be asked about the challenge that you had done before. And the questions that you're going to be asked is if you got into flow or not, like if you were able to find those hours to like actually do some deep quality work. And if you didn't, then there's an issue, like either you don't know how to get feedback on what you did, or you didn't have clarity of what the challenge was or what the goal was at all. And so we have to like address that and talk about it. Or like maybe you couldn't find a place that was quiet enough to do it. So, and that's going to be the question, like you're either going to be given a challenge or you're going to be asked, did you get in a flow? Why? Like, if not, why not? And then Mondays will be a day that we set up and we just talk about schedule. And so if there is going to be a missed meeting that week, we can talk about it. And like if there's any conflicts or anybody's missing or something like that, we can, like, that's the day that we actually talk about it. And I think the big thing for Monday is setting up any times for collaborations. So most work will just be done on your own pace, your own space, whatever. And like any of us working together is just these standing meetings to be like, yeah, I did. It's like, oh, I had issues with it, or these kind of things, like these regular checkups, these every other day checkups or whatever it is. But other than that, there are some tasks that I think, like the PDF, that it requires a collaboration, that you need someone else giving you the feedback that you need to get into flow for the object or for the task. And so for collaborations, I just kind of defined collaborations are for when feedback from another facilitates flow in a necessary challenge. And
instantaneous.
Yeah. And okay. I think that helped us get into flow with some of the things we did with Charlie. So if there's a Monday morning when we're scheduling, if there's a time that if a task needs collaboration, we will schedule the collaboration then. And then we just do that and the collaboration can't exceed 90 minutes, just like before. And then that's it. That's the end of our like meetings and rules for this group. Like having default stand-up meetings, they last very little. You get asked if you were into flow with the last challenge, given the next challenge, and then we're off for the races. If there's any collaborations that need to be, we'll schedule right then.
Sounds great to me.
Yeah.
Cool. I mean, do we... I guess... Yeah, I mean, I got no objections. It's just like, do we have enough to talk about Monday, Wednesday, Friday at this point?
With a like, stand-up?
Yeah.
I think Monday, Friday, where we sort of assign challenges and check in on them, I think that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, per week.
Yeah.
And like, and 4 hours a day, 20-hour weeks.
If you want to hear my own personal rules about work is going to be I'm not working after 6 p.m. Like, I don't do anything productive after 6 p.m. I'll have one day of the week, one weekday, that I actually don't do anything. Like, I'm not going to schedule, like, and that can change as long as it's, like, preemptively changed. So, like, right now, like, Thursdays are a great day for me to have, like, a day that I do nothing. That's just really important for me during the week. I will also, my work day will be no more than 4 hours in flow, because that's just the max. And so, like, if I do two sessions of an hour and a half, is that equal to four? Whatever. Two sessions of an hour and a half, that it's like, I'm spent, like, me sitting around for the next eight...
Yeah, two sessions of an hour and a half.
8 hours three. Is, yeah, whatever. The less, the better. It's like... I don't know, like, there's so many times I felt dumb sitting here for 10, 12 hours, and it's like, I did a session of 2 hours of, like, great work, and if I had just left then, like, it would have been, like, cashing out in a lottery, and it's like, then I could have refreshed...
Or the casino.
Casino, and then I could have, like, refreshed my brain and then came back and done another high-quality session the next day, and I think it's really blocking to, like dwindle your... brain whenever it's taxed.
Yeah.
And then I'm only going to check emails on work days, but not while I'm in flow. That's it. Those are my rules.
This concludes Ben Brown's work rules.
It's almost like, Ben Brown is beginning a flow school.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I would love to go to a flow school. Yeah. I'd love to get a degree in flow school.
Yeah, so then, like, now the goal isn't, complete a video. Did you complete a video in a month? It's, when you were given a challenge, did you have everything you need to get into flow? Like, if not, that's what we fix during the meetings.
Sounds great. Well, I think that this is a good place to close out this episode of The Film Sommelier with Caleb Brown.
Hi.
And his brother Ben Brown.
Oi.
And once again, I am your liaison, Charlie Deist.
Thank you, Charlie.
And we will be back soon with an update on what is coming next from the Story Locker.
Thanks for listening to the Film Sommelier podcast. For more insights into your favorite films, go to thestorylocker.com.